You were teaching at an upstate college, weren't you?
I'm still teaching there.
How often do you teach
there? I teach there one time a year.
From when to when?
From March to the end of May. So strange, the games you play with, what tapes you do. It's so, no, it's very exciting.
So what school is it upstate that you were teaching?
Well, I teach Milton and I teach Shakespeare. I think I teach the 17th century, the great British tradition.
I've just forgotten the name of the school.
Hobart.
Hobart, that's right. And you were also, as I recall, teaching in Philadelphia, weren't you?
No, well, I was lecturing there, just briefly, when I saw you. But I haven't been teaching there.
Well, now it's been 2 years or so since Journey and...
Yes, it's been 2 years. Two long, strange years, yes.
Yeah, well, you're going to have to fill me in on what you have been doing over this two-year period.
Well, I've mostly been writing in different places. I made one big change in my life. I decided to live in Paris, which has been greeted with howls of derision by all my friends who think, my God, this is the stupidest and silliest thing to do. Everybody decided to live in Paris but 40 years ago. But I lived in Paris all last year, and it gave me such a new lease of life. And it's also Paris is an amazing city. Somebody said it was like the Benares of Europe because everybody came to it. All the exiles find a home there. And suddenly, for once, I feel that I'm not an exile. I'm at home in the Benares that's Paris. So I've been living there, and I've finished another two novels since I last saw you, another book of poems.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going back to Paris to take up a small room that I've just found there. And it sounds like I go back to Paris because Paris is such an event, if you ever allow it to happen in your life. It becomes such an obsession. It's a very interesting place, too, spiritually, because Paris is now the centre of an awful lot of Tibetan things. They built the most funny Tibetan temple in the woods in Vincennes, which was opened with terrific antique glee about 2 months ago, which I was at. It was quite the happiest and zaniest performance because you saw a lot of Parisian rock stars, models, street workers. I mean, everyone you could possibly imagine participating in the celebration of this new temple. So I'm going to be very close to that. I live on the left bank, and I live close to great friends, great Parisian friends. I'm very interested in French literature at the moment because it seems to be able to combine all sorts of different things like realism and magic and spirituality in ways that the English really aren't. They are not getting out of their vicarage gardens, and I'm tired of the vicarage gardens.
So Paris is it. Paris is the home base from now on, huh?
Well, I hope it is. The word home always fills me with neurotic dread because I'm one of those people who think for many years that they want two things, a lover and a home. Of course, whenever you get either, or both, which is the worst possible combination, it's when you leave, or when you... I think we always dread to face our desires, and I have achieved at least one desire, finding a place which I want to be my home. So I'm full of longing and trepidation. Because it is quite important where you write. It helps so much, the different locality, especially if you are very sensitive to buildings and...
Well, there is a geographic vagueness about yourself. You were, as I recall, you were born in India.
I was born in India. I spent my childhood in India. I went to private school in England for 10 Holocaustic years and then went to Oxford. So I had this very traditional, in a way, although all traditional English upbringings are so fraught with violence and madness, you can hardly call them traditional. But then I went to Oxford, and then I decided to get the hell out of England because it was stifling me and boring me too much. And I went to India, and then really all this new part of my life began in India because I'd deliberately buried my Oxford roots, spent a year in India, and had organized my life around India and the work that was coming out of that experience that I'd had in India. Since then, it's taken me to America.
So for Andrew Harvey, there was a pre-Buddhist experience.
Oh. yes, I mean... Yes, of course, but it's only now that I'm able to use it, actually, because for so long I was running from the person that I was, because I think if you have a very deep, or a deep spiritual experience, you rather despise and put down the person that you were before you had it. You think of them as frivolous and hysterical and...
What sort of person were you before this pre-Buddhist period?
Well, I was very dark, I think, very, very self-absorbed, very melancholic, extremely angry. Very angry. Somebody said to me the other day, I said, what was I like as 21-year-old? It's a friend of mine. He said, you were the incarnation of rage. And I thought, I was terribly flattered, because to be the incarnation of rage is flattering. But I'm very glad not to have that person.
What were you so angry about?
Oh, I was angry at everything. I was angry at... Well, I was angry at my parents. I was angry at England's stifling atmosphere. I was angry at this very strange, lush institution which I belong to, this college, this elitist college, also a college which is supposedly very grand intellectually, but full of people who did nothing but research on the comma or the comma in 17th century. I mustn't say this. Delete all this. But I was angry at the whole... And I was angry at what everybody's angry at, the angry at the death of our civilization, the death of the whole business, the feeling that anything that I was doing was totally without meaning. What does it mean, really, to write a poem, to create a book, to lead the sort of rather severe life that a writer has to lead, if, in fact, nobody's reading it, if the language is decaying, if the world is heading towards apocalypse, all those things that people think. I mean, I still think that.
Was there any one episode that led you into your... interest in Buddhism, or was this a gradual turning?
I've never really told the story properly, because when I wrote Ladakh, I had to simplify so many things, because when I went to Ladakh, I'd already spent years and years in India, and years at different kinds of ashrams in India. So really my interest began with a passionate interest in Indian philosophy, which is an interest primarily in Hinduism. And my early experiences, whatever they were in Hindu. We were in terms of Hindu reality. I lived in an ashram in India, in Pondicherry, Aurobindo's ashram, and Aurobindo I revere and consider one of the very great thinkers and masters. So I wasn't really interested in Buddhism. I'd been very moved by the Buddhist sculptures that I'd seen in Sri Lanka, and also by one particular European Buddhist priest I'd met when I was in Sri Lanka. I'd been moved by him because he was so tortured. He hadn't achieved peace, but he had gone out to live in a cave in which he was visited by leopards and looking across the sea, and he had taken what seemed to me then an insanely brave step, and he was extraordinarily lucid about himself, and I admired him very much, so I talked to him a lot, and out of those conversations I suppose an interest in Buddhism came. I'd always been fascinated by Buddhist art and Chinese art and Japanese art and the tranquility and the beauty of them, but it was really through a set of circumstances that I went to Ladakh. I think often about my interest in Buddhism, obviously, and I wonder if it isn't much more an interest in the kind of person that I met in Ladakh, and the kind of person that Tibetan Buddhism produces. I'm not so much interested in philosophies. I'm interested in what a culture, a religious culture, what kind of a personality a religious culture creates. And the person that I met, the old Rinpoche, was so exciting, so warm, so generous, so amazingly loving and intelligent that I thought, my God, you know, what made him like that? How could such a person exist? And that was what was exciting. And although I'm very absorbed by Indian philosophy and have studied it and think a lot about it and think very highly of it, I'm much more interested in how it's translated into practice, into daily practice. I suppose that's what makes me a Westerner in that sense. I'm not so much interested in following it into the higher reaches of metaphysics. I'm very interested in seeing what application it can have to our lives. That's also what makes me a writer, because I think that's why I've been writing about in this new novel, One Last Minute, I've been writing about two very complicated, destructive people trying to work out some kind of truth in their lives, rather than writing about, as I wrote in the Ladakh book, very people who've achieved a certain kind of holiness, because in fact, it's easier to write about the holy, because they are there they are emanating, but the people like us, I assume, perhaps not you, like me, who are sort of crawling in the mud of their lives, trying to make some sense of their passions, they are the people who I admire in a way, deeply, because it's terrible to have so many complexities in one's personality, to have to be battling with them all the time, and to try to battle with them in a way that makes sense, and leads to the truth.
Well, One Last Mirror does overtly reflect your preoccupation with Buddhism, much more so, I think, than the poetry. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't agree, actually. I think that the poems are so Buddhist that they never have to refer to, which is, of course, the great Buddhist vanishing trait, but they are poems about the destruction of illusion, the poems about the war between the part in our minds which are very, very which is very, very honest and lucid, and the other part which enjoys the games and the manipulations that it plays. And that is actually central to the experience of Buddhist meditation, that if you are doing very, you know, serious meditation, what you are watching when you're doing, watching with grim amusement, are the different vanities as they parade themselves in front of you, the different games, and you're trying to savage them or to puncture them or to just watch them. And so the poems really came out of, actually, they were written out of 3 months of meditation in the Himalayas, and I came back, and I wrote these very savage, and I hope funny poems, well, coming out of that experience of what the mind is like when you finally face it.
The puncturing that you just mentioned, there's one poem in here that I thought is the epitome of that, and that's the one called Lament.
Yes, very much, oh my God.
Where Lydia...
It's my favourite Old Testament poem, too, so that's why I was really doing myself
it is, Lydia, it's the ultimate put-down of Cando and Lament. That was one of the best poems in here. In One Last Mirror, David is your hero, if you call it that.
He's a very shabby hero.
But well, I'm not sure. Now, you mentioned, you described David as troubled. And yet, I thought that David certainly had it better put together than the narrator. What's her name?
Oh, yes. I think that is true.
Savvy. Somehow I saw David as much more advanced in terms of Buddhism and much more at peace.
Which is one of the ironies of the book, that you have a Westerner, a tortured Westerner, talking about Buddhism in this very earnest and sometimes rather aggressive way to an Easterner. That's one of the things, of course, nobody ever notices that when they review books, but the book is about an Eastern woman writing about her Eastern experiences, having met a Westerner who's taught her about the East. I'm trying to explode all the different sort of beliefs that the West can't go to the East and the East and West and East can never meet, because it's such nonsense, all that. It's what it takes is earnestness and seriousness on two sides. But David is more put together in one sense, in the sense that he's been very burnt, and he's been very honest about the ways in which he's been burnt, and also that he's been extremely brave. But then he hasn't had the kind of context that she's had, after all. She's a woman, she's an Eastern woman, trapped by her beauty, her great beauty, and by her family, her position, her wealth, in this world, and also trapped by her a sleepwalking kind of vanity into these liaisons with these various men, and finally with her husband, who is homosexual and who does kill himself, and who produces this mad marriage, produces these desperate children who then enclose her further. It's very much more difficult for her than it is for David to break free, to make the astounding choice. But she does, I think, and in a way her courage is worth not as much as his courage in the end, because she's able to, with all that, to set sail for the new thing.
Well, there was much in One Last Mirror that wasn't clear to me, and perhaps...
You're not the only one, I must tell you.
Well, perhaps the book is best personified by the folktale in here.
You mean the Zen story?
The Zen story where the courtesan found the hermit and...
the story of the mirrors.
Promised to build him a castle or something if he brought his mirrors and set them up, and she studied and said she had the answer and reported back to him, and no, she did not have the answer. Go back to work, and she sat there. And finally, at the end, she had the answer after many, many years. But it's not clear to me what that answer was. And I think that... I don't think you want to tell everybody directly, and you certainly didn't, but what is the significance of the mirrors?
Oh, God, the mirror is the central image of the entire book, because, well, first of all, in Buddhist thought and in Hindu thought, the mind is continually compared to a mirror. Most of us have dirty mirrors, mirrors that are blotched and covered with whatever mirrors are covered with. We all know what that is, blood and semen and desolation and fog and all that. And the task of meditation, the task of truth, the task of honesty is to clean the mirror so that reality is reflected seamlessly in it, so that when the mind confronts a situation, a person, and it confronts it without prejudice, without discrimination, and with total shining presence. So the image of a mirror is the central mystical image of the East. We are to clean our mirrors, to become like the mirror that reflects reality without prejudice, without discrimination, and we are to be for others the perfect mirror in which they can see themselves reflected, not as they would have us, not as they would have themselves reflected, but as they will see themselves afresh in this contact. So the mirror, therefore, plays the role throughout the book. First of all, it's what they're all striving to become. Both David and Savvy are trying to become as honest and as lucid as the mirror. They're trying to clean their very dirty mirrors. They're trying also to be mirrors for each other, to mirror each other in a way that very few people dare to do for each other, because they are taking each other on the most severe voyage of all, which is to expose the entire darkness. It's easy to relate to someone else's beauty, their intelligence, their wit and all those things, but what is most difficult and perhaps the most profound work of love is to relate to someone else's horror, and they are able to be mirrors to each other's horror. There's also a way in which they are attempting to break the mirrors. Mirrors are also, in a Western sense, a symbol of vanity, a symbol of illusion, a symbol of desire. You want the person in whom you can throw your best profile, really, or see yourself at your most flattering. Or your thoughts, the constructions that you build around desire, are like a palace of mirrors. Do you remember that scene in The Lady from Shanghai, that great, great scene, which actually obsessed me when I was writing the book, the scene in which Orson Welles is in a fun fair, and he's hunting Rita Hayworth, I think, at that moment, and he shoots at all the reflections in the glass, and finally all the glass is shattered, and there you see this person left alone in this broken, desolate world of mirrors. And that affected me enormously when I saw it, and that is partly what I'm trying to do in the book, to leave both of them alone with all their mirrors broken, facing each other, talking to each other. That's it. One last mirror. I called it one last mirror because, of course, the act of writing is still a narcissistic act. You don't escape from narcissism and illusion when you write. In fact, you participate in it. You create a work of art. You create another hall of mirrors. So one last mirror. One last mirror, because it is the last mirror she will ever look into, because she's dying and she is hopefully going towards some kind of enlightenment in which mirrors will play no part. But she's writing, so it's one last mirror. One last mirror. It's a joke. The book turns on that. But the story itself is, I think, my favourite story in the world, because it is a story. The end of it is that the courtesan achieves enlightenment when she's been in this room full of mirrors, and nobody knows for a long, long time why she has achieved enlightenment. But when she dies, they find under a pillow a note which says, "The mirrors are empty." I think that is perhaps that. I don't know why I find that story so moving. I think probably because of another quote. From Milarepa helps understand that. Darrell puts it at the beginning of the Alexandria Quartet, for which I will love him always. He puts this quote from Milarepa. He says, "Seeing emptiness, have compassion," which I think is one of the great remarks. And seeing emptiness, seeing the emptiness of all we want and are, and of our illusions about the personality, and of all the things that we think we desire, seeing all that, seeing the emptiness of things as they create themselves and die and fade away, have compassion. Have compassion, because compassion springs out of the heart when you see people fighting, killing, murdering for what is nothing, for what means nothing, for what can never be nothing. And so, must always be nothing. So, the mirrors are empty, says, there's nothing going on in the mirrors, there's nothing going on in the mirrors. Nothing ever has gone on and ever will go on. It is a farce, the way in which we live our lives. It's for nothing. It's nothing's claiming nothing for nothing. And that's what that illusion is. And it frees you to contemplate existence, and also to have great compassion for those caught in the web, for the part of the ego that is still suffering in that web of mirrors, because that's another image really the book is about. It's a web of mirrors. And they both do have compassion on each other in the book. They really do. And compassion is a very, very difficult thing, I think, to achieve. We talk about compassion, but the compassion that can stare out someone else's appalling violence is really a very difficult compassion to achieve. And they have seen the emptiness of themselves and of their lives and of each other and of the whole. Finally, she has the great luck, I think, of seeing the emptiness even of her passion for him. She dissolves him. She says at the end, "I return him to the powers which sent him to me." Everyone is only a messenger of something else, a part of this other cosmic thing. I hate the word cosmic. But it is really what it is. It's like reality sends us messages and people are those messages. But we must give them back to reality. We mustn't possess or iconize or make them important. Otherwise we make them a mirror. We have to break them too. And she does. She dissolves her passion for him. She dissolves him.
Well, Andrew Harvey, it's certainly interesting to see how your obsession with this philosophy has taken command of your life, and now I've reflected in
this. I'm so sorry. I've been talking for nothing less than three.
Well,
can I re-enter the world?
That is not. That was not a criticism. It's interesting. I noticed that you are the third advocate, believer in Buddhism that I have talked to, who's a writer in the last within the last 6 months or so. I recently did a
lot of us about
lengthy interview with Allen Ginsberg.
Oh God, how lucky! What an amazing man.
He certainly is. But there's another one that you may not have heard of, but who has created a Zen Buddhist detective who works out of Los Angeles. His name is Howard Fast.
I have just seen his name today. I've heard a lot about him. I mean, I've heard about it. What a wonderful thought. A Zen Buddhist detective. That's what we want on our side at all moments.
He writes under a pseudonym. I think it's called V.C. Harrington, I think it is. I think it's Harrington. That's a...
It's a terrific idea, isn't it? What a great idea.
Because Fast is a Howard, is a Mifflin writer. But he's,
yes, he is.
This has also commanded his life. But in a less overt way, because he still will write a book, and it seems like a story, a very heavily plotted story at the beginning, a middle, and an end. Nothing as philosophical as One Last Mirror.
It has a beginning and a middle and end. I mean,
yes.
It's not a conventional novel, of course, but it does have, you know, he arrives, they quarrel, they go on a voyage, he goes. But it's, as you say, I mean, it's trying to do something very inward, internal. But I have written other...
There's not very much sex in it, though.
No, that's true. That's one of my friends saying, well, when are you going to write a book when somebody goes to bed with someone else? And I said, well, I don't know.
What does Zen say about that?
About going to bed with other people? Oh, enjoy it, I think. I think that's what Zen says. I think that, I remember fun enough once, I can still, it was a very funny occasion. I was at Sarnath once, and...
You were where?
Sarnath is a Buddhist shrine in India, and I was... traveling with this wild Englishman, and I said to him, who had been with some guru, and I said, what does your guru say about sex? And the Englishman looked at me and said, you should have it four times in a life. And he said, no, four times a day. I thought that was a very good recipe for happiness.
That's good advice.
It's good advice.
Hear that out there?
I think that the reason why I don't have sex in my books is because I think that the relationships that happen around sex are so thrilling. Because it's often the most important relationships are erotic, but inexpressible. And so you have to use every other way of reaching someone else than your body. Sex can be such a... I like poems, and sex is a telegram. It's, you know, there are longer things to do with people than to make love with them sometimes. And I also... I tell you the reason why I have never written about sex is because sex is too rich and too ecstatic for me. Perhaps after Holin, after trying to describe the Rinpoche, that's actually true. It's the thing that I think a writer should be at the height of his powers before he approaches, because so much sexual, nearly all sexual writing that I know is absolute rubbish, bears no relationship to the experience that one has, and there's nothing, and it's because the real experience is so naked, so extraordinary, so how on earth... And the writing that one reads about it is so vulgar and so violent, but we have to forge a new language for sex. And that's what I want to do in my next book, because it's going to be a book about... that's my next book. No, but it is... But what else can one do? You know, you
Andrew
have to
Harvey writes about sex.
Yeah,
for the first time. Yeah, you could call it that, the first time.
Yes, I will, actually. But I'll have to have it before I write about it, won't I? No, but I mean, you know, it is... Or do you? Can you? Do you think one can get away with never having had it?
Well, yeah, yes, you can. I'm told. There's this Catholic priest in Chicago named Andrew Greeley. He claims to be a virgin.
And did he write?
I don't believe him, of course. But he's written the most graphic sex scenes in some of his trashy novels, all of which have become bestsellers. He's not Houghton Mifflin, is he?
No. Oh, I hope not.
He takes it from Confessions.
Yeah. That's true. But seriously, don't you think that sexuality is very badly written about? I mean, don't we all agree that it's actually... I never read anything that's recognizably like what I go through. I mean, what anybody I know goes through.
No, I haven't either. Andrew Harvey, I want to thank you very much for coming back and talking to me after this two-year hiatus. I hope that we'll be able to do it again the next time you're back. And
there'll be sex in the next
book out, and we'll do it again. The sex book we'll be looking at.
It is actually a sex book, actually, the next one.
I want to thank you very much for coming back.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure having you.
It's a great pleasure to be here.